when does that clock start? And what the regulation says is when you become aware. And what does that mean? Who becomes aware, right? And it's basically the simplest way to describe it is anybody that works for your company that is aware, that is the date that the clock starts.
Welcome to the Global Medical Device Podcast, where today's brightest minds in the medical device industry go to get their most useful and actionable insider knowledge direct from some of the world's leading medical device experts and companies.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Global Medical Device Podcast. My name is Etsy Nichols. I'm the host for today's episode. Today, we get to talk about a wonderful topic of MDR, not Europe's MDR, but the medical device reporting for the FDA. Every medical device company in the U.S. is likely going to be faced with some form of this at some point in their existence, I would assume. So with us today is, to talk about this is Lisa Van Rijn, a medical device guru here at Greenlight Guru. Lisa, how are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Doing well. Why don't we start by talking a little bit about your background? Because it's the first time you've been on the podcast, and we typically like to do a meet the guru so people are aware and kind of get to know some of the gurus here at Greenlight Guru. So tell us a little bit about your journey and your origin story and how you got to Greenlight Guru.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. So my origin story, I probably didn't start out in the medical device industry like most people did. I came here out of the restaurant industry as a restaurant manager, where I had to deal with quality inspections in terms of ServSafe certification for food safety. And I came over and I started working for a contract manufacturer many years ago. And it was a great experience, a lot of opportunity to learn. And basically, my entire career has been a development of someone saying, we need somebody to do X, Y, and Z. And I would just say, I'm pretty sure I can do that.
Figure it out.
Yeah. In a lot of cases, it was a case of me being thrown into a frying pan and just figuring it out, learning from a lot of great mentors in the quality realm, in the manufacturing, engineering realms. And I have just really made it a point to step up and take on the next new challenge, which eventually has brought me from being just a office assistant all the way through being quality manager, quality engineer over the last 16 plus years. I worked for OEM contract manufacturers, implantable devices, cardiology devices, and just have had a lot of fun being a quality nerd, and which some people may appreciate, others may not so much. Like, I don't want to deal with any of this quality stuff.
I'm sure if they're listening to the Global Medical Device Podcast on quality and regulatory topics, they're okay with it.
Right. Of course, for sure. But all of that has brought me here with my experience to be a medical device guru here at Greenlight to help our customers learn how to use the software to implement, to go through going from a paper or another EQMS over to GG. And just helping them along their journey with even things fundamentally in terms of industry knowledge, experience, best practices, state-of-the-art type of activities. So,
yeah, I wrote something once where I talked about what is a medical device guru, because a lot of people ask us that question. And I basically said that we look for people who have a beginner's mindset, but the heart of a teacher. And because you are constantly learning, but you're also constantly teaching. And so it's just constantly looking forward and looking back. And so, no, it's always fun to see who winds up in those roles and get to talk to those people. Usually when I have a Meet the Guru episode, I like to lead up to the conversation by asking, what do you consider yourself really good at, or what are you a specialist at? And I know you had the similar response that a lot of gurus have, like, well, I don't know if I'm a specialist at anything, but you spent a lot of years doing a lot of different things. And so one of the things sounds like we landed on was medical device reporting. So I wonder, how would you like to start down that road or topic?
Well, everybody needs to consider and deal with medical device reporting. And if you think that you don't, I would definitely start re-reviewing the guidance documents and that FDA regulation in typical, in fashion when it comes to complaints, the definition for complaints, what that means, and the things you need to really take into account and consider. And really, when it comes to complaints, what it is, what is that definition coming from the definition section of Part 820.3, is that a complaint is any written, electronic, or oral communication that alleges a deficiency related to, and this is a big one, think about every single thing on this list, is the identity, the quality, the durability, reliability, the safety, effectiveness, or performance of your device after you've released it for distribution. So once it is out on the market. So you really need to break down that definition and keep those things in mind when you're considering, first of all, is this a complaint? And now, in terms of things, particularly with EU MDR, complaints are much bigger than that. Now we're talking feedback these days, where it's like, even if the customer doesn't like the color of your device, yeah, you probably want to document that. Because it technically is a complaint. But also, positive feedback is good to document as well. But one of the things when it comes to the FDA regulation is that every complaint needs to be evaluated to determine if it is reportable under Part 803 of the medical device reporting chapter. And so what I really think is important to consider is, in doing that evaluation, are you asking yourselves the right questions to determine if you need to report that complaint as a medical device adverse event or device malfunction?
So with the medical device reporting, it's essentially you're taking a complaint and you're trying to determine how you're going to handle this. If it's severe enough, maybe we need to tell the FDA just at a high level. So that being said, maybe we can back up a little bit and think, okay, what are the different ways in which I might receive a complaint? Can we talk about that first, the inputs, and then what we need to do as an organization?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I have had experience receiving complaint inputs from the facility directly in terms of the physician, hospital, a technician working in the OR may be reporting those complaints. In some cases, they may report them directly to a resource at the manufacturer's location. In a lot of my experience, we have had sales representatives out in the field at cases collecting that information. And in other cases, maybe it's device that goes directly to the patient with its own IFUs, and the patient just uses it. Maybe there are technical difficulties or the device breaks and the patient says, hey, can I get a replacement? That's where another resource of input could come in from. But you can theoretically receive input for your customer feedback and complaints process from any source that says something about your device, like any written, electronic, or oral communication. And we used to talk back in the old days, like if you're at happy hour and one of your customers is there and says something to you, technically you're being made aware of an issue. So I would take any input source. Even employees can identify issues with devices and report complaints as well.
Okay, so let's just kind of play through a scenario, if that's okay. We'll do a little role play. So if a physician calls the facility on the phone and they say, I've got an issue with this scalpel that I just used. It was bent or something when it came out of the box. What is the organization going to do?
You're going to need to document it. The requirements of Part 820 require you to keep records of all of your complaints, customer feedback, information. So you would have a procedure or process to document. If you have Greenlight Guru, of course, you're going to document that in our customer feedback workspace and capture as much information as you can about the complaint. Who is reporting it? What's the facility? Do you have a name of a person that you can contact? You might need to follow up and ask additional questions. In my experience, the follow-up process has been hit or miss, because in a lot of cases, particularly with physicians, it's not something that they can bill time for. So getting responses from physicians sometimes is a challenge. And sometimes you can reach out to a tech that might have been working in the OR or even the facility itself. But response on follow-up is often challenging. But take whatever detail you can get, particularly about the details surrounding the event, what exactly occurred, maybe even try to follow the steps in the process. In some of my experience, some facilities are even willing to share like procedure notes or real actual documented details of the case, which always can be very helpful in determining that. And in a lot of cases, you may be questioning, is this serious injury directly tied to our device? If it's questionable, oftentimes the physician may say, absolutely not. This patient had a lot of pre-existing conditions and your device did not impact this. You know, so all of those things should be reviewed, documented. You know, you definitely want the date the event occurred, where it occurred, and who was participating in the event. If you can get that device back, get it back, because then you have a whole nother process of doing analysis on the device to see maybe there was a malfunction, maybe there was a user error. Any of these things should be documented as part of the record for that complaint.
And so maybe I skipped ahead a little bit too far. Let's just assume maybe you have been dropped into a startup who is just now building out some of their documentation for their complaint management system. How are you going to set that up? And what are some of the things that maybe you see companies not do well, maybe some pitfalls that they get into?
Yeah, definitely. You need a procedure. You need a way to collect the data, a process for documenting what information is valuable and relevant. I'm sorry, what was the second part of your question?
Yeah, the second part is like issues that people get into. I was actually just bringing up my ISO 13145. I just did some lead auditor training and I have it on my desk, and which I'm super pumped to have a hard copy back with me. I don't know, I lost my last one, but just the feedback, just some issues that you see or could potentially see companies getting into when they are building out that part of the organization. Because now I'll just give some experience or an example from my experience. I can remember going to a quality engineer's office or a desk. He had a cubicle and he had stacks and stacks and stacks of paperwork. And he was struggling to get through the all of the different complaints because he managed, I don't know how many product lines he was in charge of, but he handled all of the complaints that came through there. And I don't actually know what the interface he worked with. I don't know all the detail he recorded. I'm assuming everything that you talked about, but there's got to be a better way. And Are there issues that you see? Yeah, companies typically mess this up, but it would be so much easier if they did this instead.
Oh, in terms of efficiencies?
Efficiencies, getting it right, you know, playing the long game. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I haven't had a lot of issues. Like I've really had the privilege of working for a lot of companies that are good at documentation in terms of what are the important things we need to consider. I had some great mentors, particularly when it came to complaints and MDRs, and some of my experience. I can say that there have been teams I've worked with in the past that maybe have been overly liberal, if that's the right direction I want to say that, in terms of, oh, maybe our product is perfect. I don't even really need a complaints process, you know, yeah. Or that customer doesn't know what they're talking about. That's not even how it's supposed to work. So taking for granted the value in assessing this information not just for the purposes of regulatory reporting. I guess one of the biggest things I would think is that if you're not taking the data and putting it into the feedback cycle to look deeply at trends in reporting, to consider what improvements you might need to make with your device or even with your labeling and IFU. Because if you're having user errors, maybe there's something wrong with your instructions. Something, you know, putting that into the cycle as part of post-market surveillance for follow-up and improvements. That is where I think a lot of companies don't invest where they should. But also, more so, if you're taking for granted the feedback that's coming in and not considering it as important, whether it's reportable or not, there is valuable data in the information that comes in.
So if I am a company that I have some complaints coming in, I'm looking at those, the trends, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's good advice. Obviously, you want to be doing some trend analysis. How do you determine, okay, this one, it's gotten to the point, or maybe we have enough little ones. I don't know which direction are those two different options that we need to do an official medical device report to the FDA?
Oh, that's a one case at a time review that you need to do.
Okay.
So there are specific questions that I recommend you consider. And one of the best tools that you can do, that you can create, is what is called like a decision tree. So more or less a flow chart. How do I know if this one specifically is reportable? So first of all, part of the regulation says that any event that you have become aware of that reasonably suggests that the device may have caused or contributed to a death or serious injury, that's really the first place that you start. So if there's a reasonable suggestion that it could be contributing in that way, then you really need to dig in deeper. And so it's either death or serious injury or device malfunction. Those are the two kind of key questions that you want to ask. And so when I'm building a decision tree, the first thing I say is, did a death or serious injury occur? And death is pretty simple to answer. That's a yes or no question, right? But serious injury is a little bit more vague.
I mean, my question.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. But that's okay, because serious injury is defined by the FDA. So when you ask that question, you say, okay, what do they consider to be a serious injury? So I even would pull that definition into the decision tree so that the person that's evaluating the information can say, is this a serious injury? And what a serious injury is, it could be considered life-threatening. It could result in a permanent impairment to a body function or permanent damage to a body structure. And then the third one, and this is the one that's most complex, is that it necessitates medical or surgical intervention to preclude permanent impairment of a body function or permanent damage to the body structure. So permanent means irreversible to the structure, including trivial impairment or damage. So if that first question is a yes, then a medical device report will be required for sure. But the type of report that you want to do, we don't know quite yet. So that would be the first step in your decision tree.
Okay. I don't want to slow us down on the first step necessarily, but I do have a clarifying question that I'm curious about. Necessitates medical or surgical intervention to preclude permanent impairment of a body function. Do you have an example of that you might not, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, or maybe I do mean to put you on the spot, but do you have an example of that you might not at first glance, this doesn't seem like it was that way, but this actually turned out to be one that fell into this category?
Yeah. So this is where things become a little bit nuanced. So if there is information in your instructions for use on how to perform a device explant, maybe a device explant is kind of an expected potential issue, but it isn't necessarily a permanent damage or injury to the structure. But if they performed the explant and also needed to apply medication, maybe to prevent infection, something along those lines, or maybe they needed to use a catheter to resolve the issue that was occurred for the device, that might be an example. Any time where the physician does something that's not expected or not included as part of the instructions for use or the typical surgical procedure for that device, speaking in terms of surgery, which is where I have had my most experience, that is something that would necessitate medical or surgical intervention. Okay, something just, to be considered.
I'm just going to put that back in my own words for the simpler minds, I guess. So I've got a surgical procedure that this medical device is involved in, steps 1 through 10, and step 4, 5 are my devices involved in those. But for whatever reason, because of something to do with my medical device, they had to insert a step 4B and 5B. And so now they've told me, hey, there was an issue with this surgery because this, and we had to come in and change the way we typically would do this. So that's the complaint. And you're like, okay, this is likely going to be an MDR.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, even if the device itself did not necessarily cause, but the surgical procedure, the procedure, it could have easily been a physician user error. Maybe they put the device in the wrong place, or, you know, the instruments they use, the scalpel they use to perform that first incision, maybe they made a slip of the hand or something along those lines. That's still related to your device because there's a procedure involved and should be documented, even if it is a user error.
And if they reasonably point the finger at you, the manufacturer, and say, hey, yes, I know this is user error, but I didn't know I was putting it upside down, and I should have known. There should have been clearly marked that that's okay. That makes sense. Definitely. Another And a similar question might be, and you said your experience is more around surgery, so feel free to punt this one if we need to, but let's say software. Software is one of those where it feels very, the industry tends to want to say, well, I'm not really a device. I'm not really interacting with the patient. Sometimes I'm not trying to be too generic there, but what if you have, and I'm going to go not even software that's involved in surgery or something like that, because of course that can be a little bit more clear cut. What about software that has to do with psychological things or is monitoring somebody or something along those lines? Any thought or input that you might have or creativity that you can help us figure that one out?
Oh, wow. And particularly when it comes to behavioral health, that is a realm I haven't ever even considered.
That's okay.
Because that's difficult to pinpoint. So I wouldn't want to speak on that as any sort of an expert, especially when it comes to like an application on your phone that might be like a mindfulness thing that's supposed to help you with depression or anxiety. That it would be difficult to measure in terms of what's reportable there. But that would be maybe a conversation for another guru or another podcast for sure.
So one other thing you had said too was the three areas: death, it's clear cut, it's binary. The other one, serious injury, and we kind of talked about the definition of that. But you also mentioned device malfunction.
Yeah.
So does that mean device malfunction regardless of the impact, or what are some thoughts there?
No, not regardless of the impact. So after you ask that first question, so let's say there is no serious injury, there is no death. The answer to that first question is no. You still need to ask the malfunction question. So did the device malfunction? And again, we're going back to the 803.3 CFR definitions of what is a device malfunction. Okay. And that is a failure of a device to meet its performance specifications or otherwise perform as intended. performance specification includes all claims made in the labeling, and the intended performance of the device refers to the intended use for which the device is labeled. So what was approved by the FDA in your PMA submission for intended use and performance. So is that question, did it malfunction? If it's no, then you don't have to report. But if it's yes, and in some cases, you don't know yet. Maybe you don't know at all if it malfunctioned, okay? Because you don't get the device back. You have no idea if somebody dropped it on the floor before they used it. So that unknown question leaves you hanging a little bit. But there's a follow-up question. So is the malfunction likely to cause or contribute to a death or serious injury? So we're going back to the first question, is if the malfunction is likely to cause or contribute to death or serious injury if it were to recur. So if the malfunction happened again, could it? Is it possible? Mm-hmm. Is it low? And if the answer is yes, then you do need to do a medical device report.
Okay. I'm just thinking of like an example of something like that. I remember, let's just say, maybe there's a device that holds a bone in place or an arm in place. While I had distal radius surgery, I had a plate put in my distal radius during college because I just shouldn't have been doing some of the things I was doing. Anyway, my arm broke. They went to put surgery on. They went to put a plate in, and so this is me being just completely creative. Who knows if this could ever happen? But let's say he slips. Something's holding my arm while he's drilling on it, but that thing that holding my arm isn't screwed down very tight, and it starts to slip and my arm could fall off, but the nurse catches it. So nothing bad happens. Maybe the nurse catches whatever fixation device should have been in place but it malfunctioned. That sounds like a potential for this area. Is that?
Yeah. Because there's a potential, even if maybe you didn't have an injury, but that type of malfunction could be an injury, then yes, I would consider that reportable.
Okay. So we talked about step one and I slowed you down a lot. What are some of the step twos and the next steps? Maybe we need to run through some of those.
So there is another level of question. So those first two, death or serious injury and device malfunction, just determine if you need to report. The third question suggests, say that I have to correct myself on one thing because sure. I missed a step. So if the malfunction was likely to cause or contribute to the death or serious injury, then it is reportable. Did I already say that?
I think so, but yeah, okay. I always appreciate a clarification. Go ahead. I just didn't
know. Okay. So you need to report, but there's two different kinds. There's a 5-day report, which is 5 business/working days.
Okay.
And there is a 30-day report, which is 30 calendar days. And you can follow all this through with the guidance for reporting for medical device manufacturers to kind of hash out the details of the reporting part of it.
And we'll put that in the show notes. Just those of you listening, we'll put that a link to the FDA guidance. Go ahead.
Perfect. So if the event necessitated a remedial action to prevent an unreasonable risk of substantial harm to public health, then it's a 5-day report. If not, then it is a 30-day report. So that last question determines which type. And what a remedial action is could be something other than routine device maintenance that is necessary to prevent that risk of harm to the public.
Okay. And so walk me through that a little bit more. Maybe I need to break that down. So if we believe that it was dropped, and this would never happen unless you drop it on the floor, that sounds to me like, okay, that may not need remedial action. We need to look into that. Maybe we need to change some of the packaging, some of the stability or the robustness of the device. But really, this is a one-off situation. But we are not really sure, and it sounds like something bad happened and we have no idea. And the next surgery is next week, and the same thing could happen. We don't have any idea. To the device that they're going to be using is the exact same device. That sounds like it could be the former or the first category.
Correct. Correct. So kind of a single one, what it says in the 803.3 definition for remedial action is that an action taken to correct just a single device is not considered the remedial action. But if there is any reason to think that devices currently on the market could cause death, serious injury, then that would be the remedial action, which in most cases would be some type of field action, whether it be a recall. That kind of activity would be an example of remedial action that would necessitate that 5-day report. So you can really get the word out and prevent risk of injury or death.
So it's kind of the difference between a broken design and a broken device.
Right. That's a good way to think of it.
Okay. Cool. Okay. That helps a lot in thinking how the time frame, 5 days versus 30 days.
Yes.
What are some of the differences? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I have one follow-up caveat, because this has always been kind of a question of when does that clock start? And what the regulation says is when you become aware. And what does that mean? Who becomes aware, right? And it's basically the simplest way to describe it is anybody that works for your company that is aware, that is the date that the clock starts. And a lot of times people might be confused. You know, maybe you are a complaint handling specialist and you receive the information from Joe Schmidt, who's out in the field, and you think, okay, this is when I became aware. But you actually have to count when Joe becomes aware, because if Joe finds out 3 weeks ago and he's like, oh, I forgot to tell Lisa that I had this adverse event, and he's reporting it on the 29th day, I still have 1 day to get that report done. According to the FDA, it would be considered late if I get it in past the 30 days, regardless of how long Joe sat on the information.
Okay. So it's kind of like the organization is the body. And I'm going to torture this metaphor, so you're going to have to tell me when to stop. But let's say I, as Etienne Nichols, and my entire body, I am the organization. I put my hand on a hot stove, and it takes my hand a little bit longer to travel to my brain to say, hey, you're burning your hand. Maybe it takes me an hour versus the half a second that it should take. The time that I'm burning my hand is from the time I put my hand on the stove. Okay, this is a terrible analogy, I feel like.
But it might be from the time you turn your... No, it's from the time you put your hand on the stove. I don't know. That maybe it is a terrible analogy.
But I'm just picturing, I guess, the organization being... There are lots of people on the periphery. Maybe people in the field, maybe people who interact with the customers, even salespeople and so forth. When they receive that information, the organization has received the information. Yeah, and so exactly. That's the way the FDA looks at that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
And I tend to be very conservative on this as well. So if they sent me an email, I typically will go from the date that they sent the email. But I always made a good practice to try to get those reports done as soon as possible, as soon as I had enough information. Now, if you have your complaint still open, maybe you're expecting to get that device back, you still want to get your report in at the 30-day mark, because there is an option in the reporting process to do a follow-up. And that is what is required, is that if you receive new information after you've submitted your first report, you need to do a follow-up again within 30 days for that typical 30-day report.
Okay. And then at some point, I'd love to get into the nuances of actually submitting that report or getting set up on the e-submitter. Maybe we don't want to do that necessarily today, but I would like to ask, what are some of the things that happen after you submit? Is there interaction with the FDA? What do they do with that information? When you have a follow-up, what do they do with that? What's your input?
So they will capture the data that you send. If there's any issues with the report, they might shoot an email back to you and say, you know, hey, there's information missing, or this was not quite clear. I have had very few occasions where I had interaction with the FDA in any way after I submitted the report. But the data is published publicly in the MAUDE database on the FDA's website. And it also is used as part of the Total Product Lifecycle database, the TPLC database, because when you put in your report, you also put in your device code with the FDA. So in the TPLC database, it will have a listing of types of harms and hazards that occurred with relation to your device. And also you can look up competitors' data as well, but you are able to go into the FDA's website and review the published information when you have those reports.
Okay, that makes sense. So it does become public knowledge. If they see something like this and competitors doing having similar issues, whatever that may be, do they ever do more of a proactive or that's not really the right word, like push-pull communication? I mean, when I think of pull information, that's just we're going to put information, you need to come get it. Versus the FDA saying, okay, there are things going on in the field right now, manufacturer A, manufacturer B, manufacturer C. And so we need to let all of the clinicians out there know that this product may have a similar, or maybe it's just this manufacturer. Does that ever, any thoughts about that?
I have not had experience with them taking action that I needed to manage or mitigate in any way, but there is always that opportunity for them to find something that might trigger an inspection or additional scrutiny. But I could definitely see that if you saw a similar type of device and all people making that type of device were having the same issue and it was a serious public health threat, that the FDA would probably trigger some sort of notification.
Issue a safety alert. Yeah.
Issue a safety alert or even require a mandatory recall or additional investigation. So I'm sure that if something was alerting them in terms of a trend, that they would dig deeper and ask for more data or follow up.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I look forward to maybe completing this conversation a little bit in the future as far as setting that e-submitter up and so forth. But I think we're on a good start. If I'm a company that needs to work on this, what are the things I need to be thinking about? Any other pieces of advice that you have for someone who's in the role that you used to occupy?
Yeah, I think going through definitely the FDA regulation on complaints, part 803 on complaints, and the guidance document that we're going to share as well. And then if you're getting started with this process and you expect to be receiving feedback anytime soon that could potentially be something that needs to report, I would get a jump on preparing the process, not just in terms of the procedure, but there is a web interface e-submitter application that you need to go through a procedure with the FDA to download this application and get that configured onto your desktop for each user individually that's going to be doing any submissions, whether they be electronic submissions for regulatory updates or for this type of thing, because the reg team probably uses this for submitting PMA supplements and whatnot. But also, there is a gateway portal. So you go through this e-submitter application to create the report, and then you zip it up into a package, and then you need this portal to upload it to the FDA's site. So getting all of that set up in advance, maybe even weeks in advance, is highly recommended because the process to do it is a little bit complicated and fraught with a lot of troubleshooting. So if you're not very tech savvy, it's going to be a bit of a struggle, but I would definitely love to cover that part of the process on a future conversation for sure.
Well, that especially sounds important if you get one of those first categories where you need to report in 5 days. You don't want to be spending that 5 days getting set up with the FDA.
No. And there might be some workarounds in the guidance documents. Like if you are struggling here, and they do have support to help you with it, but it is definitely a bit of a process. It takes some time.
We'll see if maybe we can add a link to that guidance as well, or some recommendations to help people out there too, until that next episode does come out. So
sounds great.
Very cool. Thank you so much, Lisa. Where can people find you? Is it okay if they reach out to you and ask questions if they have more?
Of course. If you are a GG customer and you have Assist, You can find me or any of our gurus on this from 9 to 5 Eastern if you have industry-related questions or questions about the GG app. We also have open office hours for our customers where you can go on online, have a face-to-face conversation with other customers and our gurus on any of our workspaces related to the use of the software. Otherwise, you can reach out to me on LinkedIn too and connect and follow me there.
Okay. Sounds good. Thank you so much, Lisa. Really appreciate you sharing your experiences and look forward to future conversations. Everybody who's been listening, you've been listening to the Global Medical Device Podcast. We'll see you all next time. Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, can I ask a special favor from you? Can you leave us a review on iTunes? I know most of us have never done that before, but if you're listening on the phone, look at the iTunes app, scroll down to the bottom where it says leave a review. It's actually really easy. Same thing with the computer. Just look for that leave a review button. This helps others find us and it lets us know how we're doing. Also, I'd personally love to hear from you on LinkedIn. Reach out to me. I read and respond to every message because hearing your feedback is the only way I'm going to get better. Thanks again for listening and we'll see you next time.